I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching, it's not human.
Gentlemen, you are about to witness for approximately 61 cents the perfect homemade silencer.
That sure is some silencer.
Just drive over to my place, kick back, get some tequila.
They're in my hair, on my skin, they're all over the place.
This is a world getting progressively worse. Can we not agree on that? What's on the dessert menu?
Damage has taken place to the normally dominant left hemisphere, and the right hemisphere is attempting to compensate.
Two hemispheres of my brain are competing?
Yes.
I could be murdered.
How'd I get here?
I tip my hat to any entity that could bring so much integrity to evil.
What if they come in through the back door or the bathroom window like that infamous Beatles song?
To sacrifice someone without them ever knowing it.
What does a scanner see? Into the head? Into the heart? Does it see into me? Clearly, or darkly.
This awe-inspiring stuff.
Hello, out there in YouTube and podcast land, you have reached Johnny Has the Keys. We talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? If you are, then let me give you a brief synopsis. David and I are old friends. We've been talking horror and science fiction movies since we were, well, into our adolescence, I guess we'd say. Maybe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And we decided a few years ago we would do a podcast, and then we decided we'd go into YouTube. But the idea and gist of this podcast was from a phrase from Night of the Living Dead, Johnny Has the Keys, which is a funny thing that Barbara says out of the blue in that movie. And I said, let's turn it into a metaphor. Let's have keys be influences of movies that influences movies further down the road, or influences from prior movies that influence the movie we're discussing for the day. Then we decided which ones we're going to do. I think we're going to do them all. We're just going to do all 100 years worth of horror and science fiction movies. So let's do a few per decade and mix it up so that people get a wide variety of different films. And that's why it seems that we are all over the board. That and we're unscripted, so we may ramble on like I am right now. I am here with my good friend and co-host, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I'm good. I am really good. I had a good week of stuff, and we try to break the ice by, have you done anything genre-related this week? Mine's pseudo-genre related, but also layered on with other things. I, because of My podcast guys that I usually listen to, my cinephiles that I listen to a lot, and I really like both of those guys, they have started doing a retrospective because of the tragedy. They're doing a retrospective on, I'm stammering, but on Rob Reiner. And so they've been covering all of his major releases and everything else, Princess Bride and everything else. And because
Turner Classics is showing them. Turner Classics movies showing them all. Yeah.
And because I did Misery and everything else, the play version, I thought I'd go back to the Stephen King again and do Stand By Me. I had not seen that movie in probably 6 or 7 years.
That's so funny. I recorded it the other day.
You should rewatch it. It is brilliant again.
Yeah.
It is such a good movie. If all of you out there listening, if you have not seen it, please go do it. It is great. I can't imagine you haven't seen it because it came out in like 86. But great cast, great writing, great voiceover, a great adaptation of a novella called The Body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But just seeing the Reiner touches in it, that if you watch the rest of his works, you can see that the act, he comes from acting, so there's a lot of acting, but also he comes from a hugely comedic father and ex-wife and friends of dad like Mel Brooks and all of that. So the comedy in it is all good and great, wonderful, but balanced, great character. Such a great character study. I'd forgotten how well Dreyfuss does in the bookends at the beginning and the end.
And it's just the narration, a little bit of narration. Yeah.
Playing the grown-up Gordy. And just River Phoenix, wow, what a loss there.
My God. But, and it's like the first thing I ever saw him in. And he's phenomenal in it. Yeah.
Crazy good. But Kiefer Sutherland, Jerry O'Connell, everybody in it is just strong and great. And yeah. Even Will Wheaton. No. Yes. Will Wheaton is really good in it.
You mentioned this, and I don't know if folks out there know what we're talking about, but you said all of Rob Reiner's ties. And when you were saying to comedy, I immediately thought of All in the Family. And then you said father and wife. And I was like, Carol O'Connor and Gloria? You're talking about Carl Reiner and Penny Marshall.
Penny Marshall. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Carl Reiner, Rob, when he was a kid, was going on the set of your show of shows and the Dick Van Dyke show and all of that, and meeting people like, Norman Lear and Mel Brooks and all of these incredible comedians. Of course,
and Dick it's Van Dyke, amazing that even though he and Penny Marshall were divorced, they both went on to become great directors.
Yes, yes.
And
I think, again, because I think they came, surrounded by a plethora of humorous people, but also they came from an acting background. And so they let their actors act and let them do stuff. The cool thing about cinephiles is Steve on the cinephiles always does tremendous research for anything that they do. So he goes into extreme detail and watches like every DVD special feature and interviews and all of this kind of stuff. And it's really interesting when he brings up, this line that we all like so much, the actor improvised that on the set and Rob said, keep it. Or, that moment where this happened, Rob made that up on the set. That wasn't in the script at all, sort of thing. So I love those kind of moments. But they're doing like 5 of his movies. They're doing When Harry Met Sally, Stand By Me.
I taped them all. That's so funny.
Oh, yeah.
I just got through taping them all because I knew they were going to be on Turner Classics.
Yeah.
So that's what
you
did.
But anyway, that's what I did. I did Stand By Me, a Stephen King story turned into a classic film by Rob Reiner. Did you do anything cool? Fun?
I did. I've been trying to keep a running list of things I do and try to pair them up to give you a segue. And in this case, I was like, I don't have any sci-fi animation that I can do a segue with. So I decided I would talk about a documentary that I just watched recently that absolutely blew my socks off. It's called Chain Reactions. This movie came out in 2024. It is a well-structured documentary of Tobe Hooper's classic 1974's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It features 5 people interviewed about their experience with this movie. as well as other movies that may have affected them similarly. And those five, first of all, it's directed by Alex O. Felipe, who also did Leap of Faith, the William Friedkin Exorcist documentary, as well as another documentary called 7852, a look at the iconic shower scene from Psycho. Ooh, so this guy is, this guy loves horror movies and he's hitting big ones. And he does it right with this Texas Chainsaw Massacre one. The cast is excellent. It's broken into five interviews. The first chapter is with Patton Oswalt, the comedian. The second is with Takashi Miike, who directed Audition. And some Japanese horror. I think he's Japanese, yeah. And Alexandra Heller Nicholas, who is another horror documentarian. She is really good. Stephen King does a segment on it.
Wow. Okay.
And Karen Kusama. And if Karen sounds familiar to you, she is because I have touted a movie that we need to cover for quite some time called The Invitation. She directed that movie. That's the one that I told you about a dinner party in L.A. And I'll just leave it at that. Anyway, great interviews. The synopsis is, again, a documentary by Alexander Felipe exploring the massive influence of Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre with these five people. The film uses interviews, archival footage, and personal experience with different formats like VHS to show you how gritty, low-budget movie permanently altered cinema and pop culture, which is funny because when I watch it now, I always see a very clean, pristine cut of it. And they show a lot of the cuts that people saw, and they are just awful.
Looks really scratches bad. And dirt and
bled out colors and stuff. It's just really,
but it adds to it. It adds to that movie, especially this, like the dinner scene and the,
One of them talked about that actually. And what's so funny is they hit every moment of the movie. So you practically are watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre while you're watching this movie. Mm-hmm. It gets 98% on Rotten Tomatoes with 43 reviews. It's fully warranted. I was doing a puzzle at the time I was watching it, like a jigsaw puzzle, and I was just going to face the puzzle and listen to it. I wasn't going to watch it. And then every time I kept listening, I was like turning. And then the second was Takashi Miike, which is totally subtitled because he's Japanese. So I had to sit down and I just, from then on out, I never got up. I just stayed on the couch and watched the entire thing. Yeah.
It was great. Gotta watch the whole thing now. Yep. Yeah.
And then I went back and watched the beginning with Patton Oswalt again that I had not watched. But I highly recommend it. It's a great documentary.
I saw that came up recently in something I was listening to, some probably doing research for something, but they were talking about influential films and Chainsaw came up again and talking about just the fact that it was such an exploitative film that wasn't exploitative, if that makes sense. It was, he didn't do a lot of the cliches of exploitation movies. Instead, it was just visceral horror just from the beginning. Yeah. Okay, so there's no segue to that, from that to... Actually, the opening sequence in this movie is horrific that we're watching.
And you need to let people know that this is also a viewer request episode.
It is. Wait, where's my notes? And who requested?
Joel Ziegenmeier?
Is that Joel Ziegenmeier. Hey, Ziegenmeier. Joel. We're doing this for you because you want us to do it. And I'm really curious for you to respond. So I expect some comments down there on what you think about what we covered today and what we talked about. We are going to science fiction world in a really bizarre way, but we are dealing with A Scanner Darkly, came out in 2006. It is written and directed by Richard Linklater, but it also is severely influenced by the original book. Or the original novel called by Philip K. Dick. It is an animated film, a unique style of animation, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And basically the synopsis in a pseudo nutshell is that it's in the near future. I think it says at the beginning, like 9 years in the future or 7 years from now, something like that. basically, the United States has totally lost its war on drugs, and drugs are everywhere. And a huge percentage of the population is addicted to it. And we are following an undercover cop who is trying to find the source of this huge drug that's taken over the country called Substance D. It creates bizarre hallucinations and paranoia. And let me see, my notes say, yeah, approximately 20% of the population is addicted. So we go into following this undercover detective who literally is undercover, but in a reverse sense. He has what's called a scramble suit. As a matter of fact, all of the narc cops have what's called scramble suits, and they wear them at the office. So they don't know who they're talking to, who their fellow officers are in the undercover world. So it's really very paranoia inflicting from the very beginning. But he basically has a group of roommates that he's staying with who are all addicted. He himself has become addicted. And we follow him struggle to keep his identity away from the people in charge. And then there's a couple of huge switches and switch ups at the very end. Had you seen this movie before?
I had never even heard of this movie.
Really?
Like, Where did this movie come from? I can't believe it's 20 years old and I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I actually watched it twice.
Really? Okay, yeah. Cool. Let's talk. What did you enjoy? What did you like? What surprised you?
I think what it is that I like Philip K. Dick, and I think that Blade Runner is probably the best adaptation of it. I've never read him. I'm assuming it's a good adaptation. It's certainly a good movie. It would be my favorite adaptation of his. Let's put it that way. But then he also did Total Recall, which when I saw it in the 90s, I thought was pretty good. And then when we covered it a couple seasons ago, I was like, this movie's awful. I hated it. And I was like, so to see this movie represent a well-beloved novel of his, I thought it was great because there's not a lot of science fiction elements to it other than the scramble suit. It's set in a reality of our own. You know, yeah. They even say this happened a couple of years from now or something.
Right.
So it's not heavy sci-fi like Blade Runner or Total Recall. And I just got into it. Plus, the cast is amazing. Cast is simply amazing. I was like, this is a great cast.
Did you like the style that he chose?
The rotoscope?
Yeah.
I didn't mind it. I was wondering why. Why would he do that? Why didn't he just film it? And then I thought, you know what? It's a great cast, but Keanu's better animated than he is live.
So much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with you because you know how I feel about, whoa. Keanu, yes.
I mean, he's not the most expressive of actors, but when he's animated, you don't notice it as much. And then you've got him surrounded with Woody Harrelson and Robert Downey Jr., and he looks like he's part of the ensemble. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great casting for it. I think from what I can tell from the research and looking into it, basically, Linklater had done this with his earlier project. So he had done it with the film right before this, which unfortunately I don't see in my notes and I can't tell you. But he had done it rotoscoping in it and wanted to do it for this just because of the hallucination. He felt he could add more to the paranoia and the hallucination by doing it. It's also very, what he called in an interview, sloppy rotoscope. So if you look at other people that were doing rotoscope in the 70s and late 70s and 80s, like Ralph Bakshi and everything, it's very clean rotoscope. This is, even when they're just sitting in the diner talking, their face is moving a little bit and shadows move and colors move across it and stuff like that. So it's very abstract and making us feel like we don't know what we're seeing is real or not and what to trust. Or not, which I thought was a pretty cool concept and thematic that worked all the way through it. It's not just the scatter suits that are changing. It's everybody I'm looking at, even sitting across from the table from me. Make sense?
Yes. I'm looking up the movie you were talking about. When did this movie come out? 2006?
86. Yeah. This one came out in 2006. Yes.
Yeah. I thought it was 20 years old. But I know he did Slacker. I know he did Dazed and Confused. But those are not Rotoscope. He did Fast Food Nation. He's Bears, the remake.
And yeah, which is what he worked on right after this. While this was being because he filmed this. And then while this was being rotoscoped, he went away and did Bad News Bears. And then had to come back. And it wasn't fun when he came back. It was a bad time. He did
School of Rock, too. But I don't see another rotoscope-looking movie.
I'll have to check my notes and find out. But yeah.
I just was curious. I know he did this Before Sunrise movies with Ethan Hawke, too. All three of them.
Yep. Yep.
Anyway, I just don't know much about him. So.
Yeah, about Linklater in general?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's done some good films. He's always worked with really cool casts. He's worked with Bryan Cranston and Lawrence Fishburne and all kinds of really great people that he's worked with. It's very interesting. He spent a lot. I think his biggest one that I noticed, that you would notice, of course, either Slacker or Dazed and Confused, because I remember us watching that back when they came out on video and everything. But then he spent years and years. He spent years and years doing the one, I think it's called Boy. And it's actually the growth of this actor, and he filmed it almost pseudo documentary style over 12 years.
Boyhood.
So he filmed, Boyhood. That's it.
I remember that. And Before Sunrise and Before Sunset and Before Whatever is three movies with Ethan Hawke that kind of do the same thing, right? Where it's progressing in time.
Literal time. He waits and shoots it. Next year, we're going to shoot two more scenes. Okay, in my notes, Waking Life is the movie that he did in rotoscope before this.
Oh, okay. I see it now.
But this set had, I think this, to your point, let's go back to the original. Philip K. Dick, when he wrote the book, it's semi-autobiographical.
Right.
He really did have lots of drug influences. He really had an entire summer where he basically still had possession of his house and people moved in. So, yes, he essentially had lost his house, had a bunch of people live there over the summer, and drugs involved and friends involved and all of that. And so it was a semi-autobiographical work that he did. Had you read the novel at all? Have you read?
The drugs intrigued me too, because I was like, he's one of those 60s drug heads that ended up being a really good writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the sci-fi twists that he does as well, but I was a little, I had to watch it twice because I was a little confused. I was like, the character, I forgot his name.
Which one?
It's Bob Arctor, the one Keanu Reeves plays.
Yeah.
Is a narc. But
correct.
He seemed like a slacker to begin with. So it was like, are they recruiting slackers to be narcs? What is this premise? How did he get this gig is what I was wondering.
Yeah, I haven't read the original novel, but I'm assuming, yes, they are recruiting people that could blend into. Because in other movies where you've seen undercover cops, they look like they're rough and grisly. Yeah. Even I remember Hill Street Blues, the guy that was always the undercover cop was I think his name was Bender or something like that, like same as Breakfast Club, but Belker was his name, but he kept biting people. That was his big deal. If suspects would run away, he would bite them like on the ankle or the hand or something, because it's just the way they are. Okay. And I've got some keys about that are movies where you have undercover cops that actually become addicted. So
that's a big plot point.
Plot point. Now I haven't seen Breaking Bad, but does he become addicted in Breaking Bad? He never takes his product, right?
It's been a long time since I've seen it. I don't think so. But his partner does, Aaron.
The other guy I hate, Jesse or whoever. He takes
Aaron Paul.
It, right?
I can't think. Jesse was his name on the show. He does, for sure.
But if you have the opportunity, I've got in my notes, Philip K. Dick wrote 45 novels, 121 short stories.
That's a lot.
And they are all science fiction. They're all about the nature of perception, reality, identity, corporations, drug abuse,
altered states of consciousness. They're all paranoid delusions, almost a lot of them. Especially, I remember when I first got interested in Dick back right after, right in college, I couldn't read a lot of his short stories in a row because you got really uber paranoid just reading all his stuff.
That's funny.
Because it's all this, don't trust anything around you. You can't, The Matrix, heavily inspired by Philip K. Dick. That's the whole thing. So, yeah. So the original story, autobiographical, but he wanted to place it in, again, what he thinks is his own version of an altered reality, the near future, where these things could happen and they could be real and they could seem real. So where all that came from.
Okay. The only other thing I have as far as production is that Terry Gilliam originally wanted to make this movie.
Makes perfect sense.
And it was in the 90s, though. And I guess maybe that's when Richard Linklater got word and decided, no, I'm going to make it in the 2000s. Yeah. Yeah, I could see Terry Gilliam doing it as well. But he wouldn't. He probably wouldn't have animated it.
No, he would have done it in his own weird style, very Brazil, that kind of look. It would have been, which may have worked or may not have.
I'm very happy with this version of it, though.
While we're in production, let's talk about the style. So this movie is rotoscoped. People need to get used to that. I do think they, except for the one poster they put out, which had everybody looking realistic, like looking through the blinds.
Right there.
Yeah.
And that's except still for animated, that. Though.
Yeah, but that's animated. Look at the difference in the two pictures you've got. The animation in that and then opposed to that whole... I don't want to call it pixeled, but it looks almost like oil painting.
Yeah, it's like different. It looks like watercolor. Patches. Like you would paint the numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, different patches on the face and the body and everything else. And like I said, even in like the diner scene, I always remember with Robert Downey Jr., and his face is still modeled and moving, and little patches are moving around it and everything else, even while he's talking kind of thing. But... So he chose rotoscoping. He wanted to do rotoscoping. I did, in studying and looking into this, rotoscoping was actually invented by Max Fleischer. I didn't know that. The big Fleischer cartoons that you always used to hear about in the 30s, but in the pre-Disney era.
I think of Richard Fleischer, and he did 20,000 Leagues, which was a Disney movie where they related. Yeah.
And I think they are. And I also think there's a Larry Fleischer that's his grandson.
He's
also
interesting.
But it was invented in 1915, so over 100 and X number of years ago.
And it kind of looks like the original Disney cartoons, like Steamboat Willie looks rotoscoped.
Well, Steamboat Willie isn't, but yes, Disney really picked up on it. Oh, the ones that I've got are, the big ones are Popeye, Betty Boop, Cab Calloway, like Minnie the Moocher, Snow White.
The Cat, maybe.
Felix the Cat, Snow White, especially dancing sequences and stuff like that. I think for modern audiences, not modern, but like when we were growing up, the first big version of it that I remember was Aha. When
the video, did for Take On Me.
The video, yeah. And then, of course, Cool World did it. And other ones will come up when we talk about keys. But Ralph Bakshi, that was his big deal, was he loved rotoscoping and loved doing it. But like I said, this is a particular style of rotoscoping that is different than Snow White, for example. You know, Snow White is rotoscoped, those dance sequences and her going through the woods, but it doesn't look like this film, stylistically.
No, they went to pains to make it seamless, whereas this film does not.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct.
Part of that... I have in production, is the struggles that they had. They spent 18 months animating this movie.
I saw that. They only filmed in 23 days, but it took 18 months to animate.
Correct. That's just crazy. A little over 3 weeks to film, but it took 18 months to animate. Part of that is because he had to leave. So he edited, put it together, had the shots that he wanted, everything else, sent it off to the animators, which were these four guys who were going to animate it. They were going to build the teams and animate it. And he went off and did Bad News Bears. Came back and they had 6 minutes done. And the studio was freaking out. And it literally was like 6 months later. and they had 6 minutes finished. And Linklater freaked and was like, what are you doing? This is, I need all this. But evidently it was really bad, what do you call, management of the animation process and the post-production process. So much so that when the four guys went to breakfast one morning, the producer came in and locked them out of all of their workstations and fired them and hired two new guys to replace them, two local artists that he had been talking about. We're having trouble with these animators and they're not working and it sucks and blah, blah, blah. And they're wanting $2 more million and all this. So a guy's named Jason Archer and Paul Beck really saved the project. And within 4 months had turned it around, but then it still took an additional 6 months, or additional year to finish all of the animation for it. So Linklater wasn't pleased at all with the whole process. He liked it at the end, but he didn't like the process that they had to go through to get it done. So budget rose by $2.5 million just to cover the 6 months of additional rotoscoping. So, yeah.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the actors are sitting around going, hey, man, we filmed that thing like a year ago, didn't we?
I have a feeling that actors are used to that shit. They've got shit in the can that they don't see for years.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. But especially with this cast, that's a good segue to cast because these guys are.
We didn't do scenes. Oh, if you want to talk about scenes. I'm going to say the opening kind of freaked me out with the. What's his name? Character Rick. Is that his name?
Rick.
Freck. Where he is basically feeling like bugs are crawling all over him. He's constantly scratching. He's taking showers. Then he sees his dog and he thinks bugs are crawling all over his dog. And he bathes his dog with him in the bathtub. And the poor dog doesn't know what the hell's going on. That whole scene there was a great introduction to this movie because I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. It's a great hook. And also to show the effects of Substance D and everything else. And it's also a great segue introduction to one of my favorite scenes, which is the scene 2 scenes later with Robert Downey Jr. and him at the restaurant. I think that's a great scene. He's trying to be calm and not be paranoid, but the whole time it's Rory Cochrane, so he's kind of like doing that whole look around with the big eyes the whole time. Meanwhile, Downey Jr. is just a tour de force this entire movie. Just everything he's talking about, and he's very, I would think nowadays he would probably be a character that's definitely on the spectrum in some way, but he's just uber intelligent and crazy and everything else.
And paranoid. Yeah.
Yeah, but also so calming the whole time. You need to do this way and blah, blah, blah. And he's just, so I love that scene.
I love the scene when they're just around the house, just goofing off. Any scene with the three of them, Keanu, Robert Downey, and Woody Harrelson, as friends just hanging out. They just crack me up. And I especially love it when you start realizing that Keanu's character's a little bit deep in with the substance. Mm-hmm. And he looks over, and all of a sudden, Robert Downey Jr. is one of those bucks sitting in a chair, and he just looks at him and goes, like that.
Yeah.
He looks over at Woody Harrelson, and Woody Harrelson's a bug too. That's great.
Something that would have cost way too much money to do practically, but you can do it with animation pretty freakily.
Yeah.
Also, the scene where they're all outside and he's making a silencer for the gun.
Yes. And then is it Woody or I can't remember which one goes and gets the instrument to hit him with. Is it an axe? I think it's an axe. No?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And that's when Freck comes over. He's there for just a few minutes. Then he's out of here. He leaves.
Yeah, he goes, I got to leave. Any of our youthful hanging out encounters reminds me of those.
I think it's the dynamic of those three actors together. I think they're just great.
Yeah.
In particular, Robert Downey Jr. and Woody Harrelson. Yeah.
Agreed. Totally agree. I also liked the scene, the big bluff scene with his boss. I think his name is Hank, is the only name he knows is Hank. And they're both in the scatter suits and he's telling him the story of what he needs him to do. And you got to watch this Arctur guy. I need you to start surveilling him and all that. And I like the fact that they It's almost like Iron Man. They cut to inside the scatters Keanu's face.
It's very much like Iron
Man. Yeah. But so you see when he's getting scared and getting paranoid and going, oh my God, they're on to me and everything. So I like that scene.
And I like the first scene with Arctos in the scatter suit. He's doing a presentation to a group of people. And when he speaks as the scatter suit, it's a different voice.
Totally different voice.
You hear him internally, it's Keanu's voice. So I thought that was really interesting as well. A really cool way of showing that difference.
Yeah, and I'd forgotten that, but that's a great introduction too to the police force and to the corporate structure. All them going, yeah, we need to get to the bottom of this, even though you know that you don't believe that they really want to, sort of thing. I think for favorite scenes too, you have to talk about the ending of this movie. The two double twists at the end are pretty good, I think. Mm-hmm. When and again, spoiler alert, if you guys haven't seen this, go watch it because we spoil. Finding out that his boss is really Donna, the girl that he's been hanging out with this entire time.
I don't have a picture of her.
The double blind that they have been setting him up, this Bob Arctor police officer, they have been setting up from the very beginning to hope that he would get addicted and would lose his marbles and would get committed.
And hopefully rehabilitated and become an internal spy, basically.
Because what their overall corporate gag is, or their overall big government gag, is the fact that the same company that is treating this disease and making millions off of it.
New Life? Something.
I think it's New Life, New Something, is the same company that is making the drugs and distributing them to people.
Right.
So very prescient and makes us feel New Path.
That's it. And he is in, and you're talking about that last scene. He's out there as a farmer on part of his rehabilitation. And you think it's corn, but then he squats down low and the little blue flowers are growing everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And he steals one.
You can't see those.
you don't see those. He goes, no, I don't. But then he takes one and hides it and says he'll see his friends at Thanksgiving, meaning the police. So
maybe. That's what I was wondering. Does that mean he is actually coming out of it, or it could? Or he could be thinking about his other friends at the institution at Thanksgiving.
Well, from what I gather, based on just research, because like I said, I haven't read the novel this is based on, but that is the ending of the novel, that he hides a flower to take to Donna, to take to Hank when he sees him at Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Yeah. So you get the idea that, maybe he will turn on New Path.
Maybe he's sobered up and is just faking it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And I think the last scene that I have is the whole in memoriam thing that they have on this, because that's in the novel too, from what I've researched. So they have all of these people that Philip K. Dick is saying died
in the credits of drugs. Yeah.
Yes, in the credits, the whole memoriam thing. I think that was very telling and very sobering, so to speak.
And I'm assuming those were lifted directly from the book.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's a fill in it, just a little trivia thing. There's a Phil in the memorandum. That's Philip K. Dick, who actually died from pancreatic cancer.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
I can move on to cast if you want.
Sure.
I'm only going to talk about five of them because really it's only the five that we know. Starting with Roy Cochran, who, as I mentioned when we talked about him earlier this season, was in Dazed and Confused, as well as he's in Yellowstone now, and a movie I saw called Antlers, a horror movie. I bet you had no idea we'd be covering two movies with him in it this season, did you?
I did not. No, I did not.
He is one of the leads in Oculus as well, the Mike Flanagan movie that we covered really early on in the season. He's great. I want to see more of him. I like him a lot.
Yes. He's really good.
Yeah.
Really good. And the part of... what is it? Freck? Mm-hmm. Is that it? Yeah.
Right. He's right.
Was created specifically. He's not in the novel. So it was created by Linklater for this film.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. He wrote it specifically for him because he thought he could give that paranoia and that very frightened.
Now that you mention it, that makes perfect sense because it is an introduction to the movie, but he's not an essential part of their friend group.
Correct. And he doesn't really do anything to the plot.
Okay, that makes sense. He's a good addition. Second, we have, it's funny, I'm doing this, I guess. I don't know why they have it.
In show order.
In order of appearance, maybe? Because
in order of appearance.
Next is Robert Downey Jr. and not Keanu. And Robert Downey Jr. plays James Barris. My God, what have we not said about Robert Downey Jr. already? He was in Weird Science, Lesson Zero, Chaplin, Iron Man, The Avengers. Bet you had no idea we'd be covering two movies with him in this season either, did you?
Somewhat understandable just because of his cred, but...
But we did Natural Born Killers a few episodes back, and he's a big part of that.
Yeah.
Richard Linklater cast Downey Jr. because he wanted someone who could be intelligent, evil, and humorous at the same time.
Yeah, because part of that big reveal in that scene that I said was one of my favorites is Arctur finding out that they're really after Barris. They're not after Arctur. They're after Barris.
I love the scene where he goes in to talk to the cops.
Both scenes with him are great.
And he's like walking his fingers across the desk. I was like, I really wish I could see this not animated. Because he's doing all this shit. I've got that he wrote most of his lines down on post-it notes and scattered them around, very Brando-esque, so that he could read them off while filming a scene. The rotoscoping team animated over the notes to prevent them from being seen.
Yep. I also have, according to notes about Downey Jr., he also wrote them down as run-on sentences. So he would change the meter of it when he was working on memorizing them and doing them. So he wouldn't have the inflection based on the punctuation. That's so he wrote them all as giant run-on sentences and everything else. And even some of them he had to convert into acronyms so that he could help memorize them. So it was very interesting, his process. If you look at some of the notes on the making of this, they talk about the process of each of them. Cochrane... I've got it at his that he literally came up with character bits like 5 minutes before the scene. He would go to Linklater and say, can I do this? Can I do this? Can I do this? And just bombard him with all of these ideas that he just came up with. Maybe not just came up with, but just approach Linklater with him for how to do them. So that's the way he worked. And Downey Jr., of course, worked with all the post-its and everything else.
Interesting.
And then Reeves, of course, read the book. He read the book and kept it on set religiously. He even marked scenes and highlighted corresponding pages.
It's just different approaches. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting.
I've got Keanu Reeves next. He played Bob Arctur, as I mentioned. We know him from the Bill and Ted movies, Speed, Dracula, which we have covered, John Wick, and The Matrix, which we have covered.
Yep.
However, when Linklater first considered Keanu Reeves for this role, he was afraid that Reeves would turn him down because he had just finished The Matrix and he thought that another science fiction movie would be out of the question. But that was not the case at all. Reeves was definitely interested. I think I mentioned this maybe when we did Dracula or The Matrix, but did you know that Keanu's mother, Patricia, she goes by Patrick, P-A-T-R-I-C, Reeves, was a costume designer, and that she did Alice Cooper's costumes?
No.
I know. That weighs highly with me because I'm a big Alice Cooper fan.
You've seen a lot of those costumes in person.
Yeah, recently, actually.
Yeah.
That's funny. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. Next up, the big surprise for me in this movie, and I thought she was fantastic, was Winona Ryder.
Very good.
We're starting to see her more again. She was big in the 80s, then she kind of dropped out of sight for a while, and then she came back. We know her originally from Beetlejuice and Heathers and Mermaids, but then she has come back. Oh, and Dracula. We've covered Dracula. But then here lately, she regained popularity with Stranger Things on Netflix. Winona said that this was the most difficult story and script she ever read for.
Interesting.
I wonder if it's because of the duality of her character, maybe.
I assume so. Yeah. I think it would have to be.
That
would be
the she is balance. A double agent in this.
Totally.
Yeah.
She's actually his boss and then cuddling up with him on the couch sort of thing.
And selling him drugs. So, yeah.
And selling him drugs.
To get him addicted. Yeah.
Yes. And then has a guilt trip at the end. That next to last scene has her and that other agent just sitting at the diner. Thinking about quitting. And talking about how morally correct was this.
Yeah.
And his whole thing was, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
So.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next, we have Woody Harrelson. Bet you didn't know we'd be covering two movies with Woody Harrelson this season either, did you?
Crazy. Crazy.
Yeah. No, another natural born killer with Robert Downey Jr. What can we say about Woody? We said it when we did Natural Born Killers. He got to start with Cheers. Didn't get jobs for years after that. But then when he finally started working, he did The People versus Larry Flint, which put him on the Oscar circuit. He has just been doing great stuff ever since, including The Hunger Games, which is a movie that we've covered on this podcast. Woody played Ernie Luckman. So they're always referring to Luckman, Barris, and Arthur, and Freck a little bit.
Freck a little bit.
That's all I really have on cast. These are all big guys, so we know them. As far as awards, the movie was nominated for several on the indie circuit. It won a few, primarily for Best Animated Feature, which makes perfect sense. It is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, which I understand completely because, like I said, I don't know why I didn't know this movie existed. With these people in this movie, why did I not know about this movie?
I think this movie got shunted a lot just because of the... Because of the animation.
Yeah.
But yeah, it bombed totally. It was like a million or a million and a half below its even production value.
Okay.
Is all it earned. Let me see. I think I've got it in my notes. Hold on. Ultimately was 1 million short of earning back its 8.7 million production budget.
Gotcha. Okay. I mean, it totally couldn't have been cheap to pay them actors unless they took cuts because that's a pretty big cast.
Both. So, yeah, a good segue to production or trivia. Keanu, Winona, and Robert Downey Jr. all agreed to SAG minimums to do the movie. So they didn't get paid a lot to do it. They wanted to really do the movie sort of thing.
Cool.
So there you go.
Well, and my
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the only trivia I have is that we were talking about Richard Linklater. I didn't really know much about him, but Kevin Smith, the director of Clerks, said that Slacker is what made him want to be a director. Slacker was an early Linklater film.
Linklater's approach is always very actor-centric, so that kind of works. Interesting that for my genre week, I talked about Reiner and how actor-centric he is. So is Linklater. Linklater likes to work with different actors, put them against each other, let them play off each other, which you totally see in this.
In this, totally, especially with Harrelson and Downey Jr. Yeah.
Think about Dazed and Confused, same way. This group of people and the way they interact is the core of the movie. Same thing with Slacker. So he's very big on that whole interpersonal relationships are the core of storytelling. This is gag. Which works for me.
Yeah.
I've not been disappointed, even though they don't rank high on my whole list of old favorite movies of all time. I think a lot of his films are really strong films. I like them. Yeah.
Okay. Keys.
Keys. Your first, you already mentioned two, which would be the Philip K. Dick other translations, Blade Runner and Mars.
Total Recall.
Going to Mars, Total Recall, which would be two big keys for me. One of my first ones was Dazed and Confused. This reminded me a lot, especially those scenes when they're just hanging out, either in the living room or in the kitchen or in the backyard. It reminded me a lot of Dazed and Confused and had a lot of similar kind of cast dynamics.
Well, and Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey favor each other a little bit. That's why
I could see that.
And I always wondered about the casting of True Detective because I was like, what, you're casting the same lead twice pretty much?
Yep.
I have, of course, Take On Me, which is the video.
Yep.
Because that's the first thing I thought of when you said Rotoscope. But I jotted Steamboat Willie down because that makes me think of Rotoscope, too.
Yeah, it can. Another one I have is again, a Philip K. Dick story, is Minority Report, the Steven Spielberg film.
Oh, I forgot about that, too.
Yeah, and that's also based on a Philip K. Dick novel.
And again, omnipresent government, always watching you, always, you know, big brother taken to extreme. You don't know what to trust. You don't know who to trust and who your friends are, that sort of thing. Not so much drug dependency, because that one's more the genetic mutation, the three prescient seers, the ones that can see the future, which is what it's all based on. But again, one of the, I've always thought it would be cool to read Philip K. Dick and Edgar Allan Poe together, because they both had such uniquely strange, kind of abusive lives, and see how that kind of plays into their fiction.
Paranoid and drug fueled.
Yeah, definitely. And both died too young, and both died because of diseases they probably could have prevented.
Right.
Whether it's alcoholism or pancreatic drug abuse.
Right. I have the Bible.
The Bible.
I always say that when I can. I said, yeah. Corinthians 13:12 reads, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as I am known." It is directly quoted from the Bible. So the title, that is, "Through a Glass Darkly." Yeah. That was "Through a Scanner Darkly," but yeah.
I think you cannot mention, I strongly suspect that Linklater was influenced by one of the biggest rotoscopers ever, who was Ralph Bakshi, who I mentioned before, who from the 70s with Wizards, he did Lord of the Rings, his version of it, which was all rotoscoped, American Pop, Fire and Ice, Cool World, all rotoscoped, full-length films. So I think that was a huge influence. I also have other rotoscope. I have Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was rotoscoped, and I did not know that.
The video?
Yeah.
The video. Are you talking about maybe?
Yellow Submarine.
Yeah. It looks, so I could see that. So would it, maybe it would be Yellow Submarine, really, the whole movie, probably.
Correct. Yeah, that'd probably be a better reference.
For I have Snow White. Less than Zero, which is another movie where Junior plays a drug addict. It just reminded me of it. It was an old Robert Downey Jr. movie.
I found it really interesting when I sat down to write notes that, like you said, so many of these actors, not only have we done them either this year or in the past, but they've paired together. Keanu and Winona and Dracula.
Right.
Robert Downey Jr. and Woody.
In Natural Born Killers.
Yeah. And there's a couple of others that where they were all paired together. What was it? It was another one that I didn't write it down in my notes. Damn it.
No. One more key that I can think of off the top of my head, and that's The Matrix.
Yes.
Because the pills were red.
Oh, yeah. The substance D was red.
Yeah. And I love how whenever they ask, how much do you take, they always say, not very much.
Yeah.
It's always not very much. They never specify how much they're doing. It's always not very much.
Yeah. And the whole subtext underneath it of you do take more. They even show him. At first, he's just dropping a couple of those tabs that Downey Jr. gives him. And then later on, he's doing three. And then you see the one where he does three. And then just a few minutes later, he takes out and does two more. When he's starting to hallucinate about her and everything else. So, yeah, it's a strangely prescient sort of movie even now in the modern world we're living in with everybody's got to be on body cams and you've got to, but then your deep fakes, you don't know. Do I trust that? Is that real? Is that not?
Now, out of all the Philip K. Dick movies you've seen, which we've already talked about on here, where would this fall? Because to me, it would be second to Blade Runner.
This would be third. This would be third for me. Mine would be Blade Runner, and we're not thinking about 49, even though that's a really cool one, but it's not based on a Philip K.
Dick. I don't think I've seen that. What is that?
Blade Runner 49?
Oh, the sequel. I got you. No, I'm talking about just Blade Runner.
So, yeah, mine would be Blade Runner Minority Scanner.
Okay. Yeah, I can't put Tom Cruise. But honestly, I think it's kind of funny that Tom Cruise is in one and Keanu's in another and Arnold Schwarzenegger's in another. That's three actors I am not crazy about.
Yep.
But I would take one over Minority just because I liked the story better.
I was looking at that. So these are keys too, and I'm glad you went there. So Screamers is another one that's based on Philip K. Dick. The Adjustment Bureau is a time-traveling one that's based on Philip K. Dick. And there was an Amazon Prime series, multi-season series, called The Man in the High Castle.
Oh, that is him. I forgot and that.
That's Philip K. Dick. But that's more societal, less paranoic, because basically the premise is
that... It's an alternate history, isn't it? I think.
Yeah. Basically, the Axis won World War II, and they took over the United States. So that's where that story comes from. But there is a series you can find. It was a BBC series. I'm not sure. I guess you could probably find it on YouTube, or one of the streamers will have it or whatever. But it was called Electric Dreams. And I've watched like four. I think it's got only has like 10 episodes, but I've watched four of them, and they're all really good. But very Philip K. Dick.
Okay.
You know, one is a guy who's suddenly, he's on a Martian colony and he's settling down with dinner with his family, and suddenly he's arrested. And they say that at the lab that day, he killed like three people. And he has no memory of it whatsoever. And it's all this big, did he, didn't he, is this a government conspiracy trial story? It's really good. But anyway, I digress. Philip K. Dick is paranoid as hell.
Okay. So it speaks volumes that there have been so many adaptions of his work.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you liked it. I'm glad I picked it to go on there. I had only seen it once before. You didn't pick
it. Joel picked it.
Oh, that's right. Joel picked it. Joel did pick it. Joel, I'm sorry. I disregarded you there. I'd only seen it once before. But Joel, let us know what you think and what your lovely wife thinks, and any of your friends and followers. Tell us what you guys think. If you liked Scanner Darkly, if you didn't, we'd love to hear from you. Also, we would love to hear in general what you think. Give us your comments down below. Ring the bell, subscribe, do all those things. We also have a Patreon if you want to support us and keep the show going. We are nearing the end of season 8 and starting the planning of season 9. So that'll be fun to see. And if you have a film that you would like for us to cover, let us know. Suggest it. Tell us.
I'm just happy that you're doing the outro for me.
I am doing the outro for you. You should be doing it.
But I was just going to let you go.
Well, no, you go ahead and finish.
You pretty much did finish. We do have some shows over there on Patreon. If you guys would like to go over there and see more of us, we've got free shows. We've got tiered shows. If you do want to help us out a little further by donating, we've got shows over there that you can subscribe to, including Star Trek. What is it? The Dilithium Chamber, which is basically us dissecting each episode of the original runs of Star Trek. And we have done 4 seasons of The X-Files on X-Files Classified. Those are, like I said, subscription-based here. But there's free stuff over there as well if you want to go over there and dip your toe in the water. And until next week, when we're not going to necessarily be in horror world, but we are definitely in suspense world.
Definitely in suspense. We've started expanding this season into suspense and fantasy. Last season, actually.
2 seasons ago.
But I don't know. There are some things that are pretty horrific
in
the movie next week. So, yeah.
And I will see you then, Dave.
I'll see you then. All right. Thanks for sharing the outro.
You're welcome. Bye.